So thanks very much. So this was the title I was basically given, and I wasn't sure exactly what that meant. So that's kind of dangerous because my mind started running and I have all kinds of things to say and I don't have enough time to say it. But this is basically my outline. It's very complicated, so I had to construct a matrix to do it. I wanted to talk, so there's you could talk about different size scales for halos. You can talk about dwarf galaxies clusters and go up in scale. Or you could talk about different properties of these things. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about shapes, the density distributions in halos, the outer parts of halos, and substructure in the many different ways that are basically that aren't gravitational lensing to probe these things observationally. Unfortunately, I don't have time to fill in every aspect of the matrix, so I'm playing tic-tac-toe and the x is 1, and I'm going to focus on density, which I understand better than some of these other things. And for the other things, I'll focus on the galaxy scale, where things are hardest. So let me just start off with densities. And what I'm going to talk about in terms of densities is just a general characteristic of how dense halos are. And so if you assume that the halos have something like an NFW profile, you can define the concentration, which is the virial radius divided by some radius where the log slope is minus 2. So there's three things that were summarized in this paper a long time ago, seems now, where you have the concentration versus mass for halos. And this was found by other people as well in many cases. First of all, the concentration rises as you go to littler things. Second of all, there's a significant scatter. In fact, the scatter is basically as important as the mass trend, if not more important. And also, halos are less concentrated at high redshift, basically because the virial radii are smaller. So if you go back to higher redshift, the concentrations go down. And it's basically described pretty well by a formula that looks something like this. So this is a fairly robust prediction. It depends on details of exactly what power spectrum you're using, what sigma 8 is, but we more or less know how to normalize this to within 10 or 15%. So these predictions are pretty good and remarkably fairly stable. Also, halo shapes. We also know something about halo shapes. This is a specific paper by Allgood et al., where S is the short axis to long axis for an ellipsoid fit to halos. And one of the trends that's noticed similarly to the concentration trend is that lower mass halos are also rounder than their higher mass counterparts. This very likely has something to do with the formation history. Mass is accreted along filaments, and that tends to be the orientation of the halo. Also, halos get rounder with time. So at high redshift, a halo will tend to be more flattened than at low redshift. And again, in some very rough sense, they form earlier. If you're looking at them while they're forming, they tend to be more flattened. So what you'll notice here is that galaxy halos are actually quite round compared to sort of the 0.5 ratios that people were thinking about in the past in terms of clusters. So finally, halo substructure. I'm just giving sort of a general background here. This is quite a well-known topic, and I'm just referencing this older paper by Klippen et al. Jörg probably may talk about this later. I'm not sure what he's going to talk about. Basically, if you take the subhalos defined in some way, which Paul wants us to define exactly, but if you define them in your in-body simulation such that you can actually see them, the mass function rises towards smaller mass things and begins to roll off where the resolution goes down. You increase your resolution, it just keeps extrapolating. There's effectively no scale. Something like dn dv max goes something like v to the minus 3.5, and the mass fraction in substructure is something like 10%, likely less than 10%, and very likely the things that form earlier have lower mass fractions in substructure because those substructures will have lost mass by tides, etc. This is basically the stage. A little bit more on dark halo substructure. Another thing, and Julio I think alluded to this, is that the subhalos themselves trace the dark matter structure. So if you have a halo that's got some major axis, the subhalos will tend to orient along that major axis as well. And one thing we'd like to do is test this or think about what the observational implications are, of course. Some hydrodynamic simulations find these specific papers here. I noted that the inner halos and the outer halos aren't particularly well aligned in many cases. And so sometimes with disk galaxies, as Julio mentioned, the Ingram minimum axis of halos is always perpendicular to the long axis, something like 90 or 80% of the time. It's very, very well correlated there. And so you would think maybe that the disk would sit like this along a halo, which is kind of an anti-Holmberg effect. But it may be that in the process of disk formation, this this gets mixed up, and there may not be a very strong correlation between the inner parts of halos and the outer parts, and that's where the satellites may sit. So let's go back to this substructure problem, which we're quite familiar with. Rising subhalo velocity function, and the satellites are here. So one thing we'd like to do is test this and think about, you know, is this a problem? What's the issue here? Is it telling us something about dark matter, something about astrophysics? So this was an old figure. So I added a few more dwarfs on there. So this is more or less pre-Sloan. This is post-Sloan, where the number is doubled. And on this particular plot, it doesn't really look like it's going to help you that much. But of course, Sloan hasn't discovered the whole sky. We might expect this to go up even more. We don't know. But the real issue here, I think, is knowing what kind of subhalos these dwarfs sit in. Really, what you typically do is you measure a velocity dispersion of these dwarfs. And then you take it and you multiply it by something of order 2 to get what you think the Vmax of the halo is. If you don't really have a great reason for doing that, that's basically the number you get for the dark matter. But there's a huge degeneracy between the kind of dwarf stellar, you know, group of stellar stars you can embed in the center of a dark matter halo and how big that halo is. You need a lot of data to really constrain it. So if you're trying to count dwarfs, and you, even if you have a velocity dispersion profile, it's very, very hard to do this. So you can think about it in terms of, let's say you have a measurement of a characteristic velocity dispersion and a size of the system. You have those two observables, and then if you just parameterize your dark matter halo, which is probably too simple, with two numbers, say the maximum of the circular velocity curve and the radius of that maximum, you basically define a degenerate two parameters. So there's sort of a line and parameter space that these observations constrain. So for example, these two rotation curves here, you can embed Carina in either of these halos and it works just fine. So it could have a Vmax of 35, it could have a Vmax of 15, it's hard to say. And here I've assumed I know the velocity anisotropy of the stars. But we don't, so this is even worse, because you really don't even know beta. So you're really, you know, when you're trying to play this game, it's quite difficult. So you can try to do this a little bit more precisely if you have some velocity dispersion profile and try to iterate of all types of dark matter halos you could try to embed this thing in, and there's a huge range of allowed parameter space plotted here in the Rmax Vmax plane. So in principle, you could put Carina in a really gigantic halo that goes way up here, you know, Vmax of 70, or you could put it in something that's tiny, that basically has the velocity dispersion of the dark matter equal to the velocity dispersion of stars. That kind of defines this space. And a priori, you really just don't know. So this is work led by a postdoc at UCI and McHugh fellow there named Louis Stragari, also work with Manoj Kaplinghat, where we're taking all the data that exists and trying to do a detailed comparison of what we can say and what we can't say. And based on the data that we have in hand right now, the best we can do is we have to assume a CDM prior, basically, to estimate Vmax. You have to assume a theory prior. Fortunately, we basically know, at least have a prediction, for how, for CDM subhalos, or even field halos, what the Rmax Vmax relation should be. So they have some relation like this. So basically, if you want subhalos to look like those in CDM or LCDM simulations, they have to have Vmaxes and Rmaxes that cross this banana somewhere. In this case here, and in this case down here. Now, this doesn't have to be the case, right? Because if the data get better, let's say instead of having a few hundred stars, we now have 1,000 stars, these bananas will shrink. In principle, you could even test whether the substructure looks like we think it should, or whether it's different, or whether it's cuspy or cored. But currently, it's our opinion that you cannot do this. So if we take our best guess with these CDM priors, for a few of our galaxies, for example, Fornax, Draco, Carina Sculptor, you're getting Vmaxes of 20, 20, 12, and 15, so pretty small, in the regime where you think RAM pressure stripping might affect them, reionization might have affected them, even though these are their current Vmaxes, it's possible their Vmaxes could be bigger. But basically, this is the situation as we see it. Vmaxes are fairly small. So is it ever going to be possible to really know without assuming a theory prior? So let's say we've got 500 line-of-sight velocity stars to a typical dwarf, and this is just an example experiment. This is, if you're trying to measure beta, you can't do it. There's a huge degeneracy, and this is Vmax just plotted in this plane. Then let's say in the future, now we have 1,000 line-of-sight velocity stars and 500 proper motions from SIM. This is what happens to the banana. It shrinks considerably, and you basically nail Vmax. Similarly, with this kind of data, we think that you'll be able to, even though there's a huge degeneracy, I think, right now between whether there's a cusp or a core in these little guys, data like this, I think, could possibly constrain this. So now you're talking about proper motions, this can really help you. So in principle, I think this would be very interesting, and then you're doing, you know, if you think about the nature of dark matter, you're doing fundamental physics with SIM. So let me move now from dwarf scales to galaxy scales. And talk about probes of galaxy halos. I'm just going to mention a few things. I think a lot of these things will come up again, but I just thought, since I was sort of early in the program, I should mention some things. So satellites and random velocities in external galaxies. You're looking at external galaxies and trying to get a feel for what the dark matter structure is, what the substructure is. So there's this work by Prada et al. Who used Sloan to measure the kinematics of satellites around galaxies, and they find, I think, a very interesting result, that the outer halos do seem to fall off basically as expected with NFW. Didn't have to be the case. It does not seem isothermal, at least at large radii. Satellite orientations, this question of whether satellites align along the poles. There are experts in the audience on this, and so I'd be interested in what, you know, say Dennis have to say about it, so I kind of not going to say that much. But the way I read it is, if you specifically are focusing on red galaxies, you really do see satellites oriented along the major axes of galaxies. And that might be expected if they formed in a major merger, sort of along the filaments, the direction that the halos are pointing. This Azzaro et al. Result, they specifically were trying to focus on galaxies that they knew were disks, and they found no conclusive evidence of any specific orientation. Now, another thing you could do is look at stellar velocity dispersions around galaxies, and you fall into the same kind of degeneracies that I was talking about with the dwarfs, and you really can't use it to probe the halo, but it's certainly consistent with what we know. Now you can think about satellites and random velocities around the Milky Way. So satellite orientation, you have this issue of this Holmberg effect where the satellites tend to sit in the poles, which may be an issue, and I don't think we know what to do with that exactly right now. Stellar streams of Sagittarius, as Julio alluded to, it looks like the halo is quite round. This may have something to do with baryonic effects. And stellar halo velocities, there's a big degeneracy. And again, it's quite hard to probe for the same reasons. And there's a very nice paper by Dennett et al. Who basically laid this out. It's very nice. Although I think in the future, as we get more and more stars and more precise velocities, not just radio velocities, but time sequence velocities for some of these things, it's going to open up a brand new window for really precise probes of our halo. So let me just throw this up here right now. Another thing we have to worry about on galaxy scales is the mass-to-light ratio issue. That is, there's baryons there. This is just estimate for the mass-to-light ratio of central galaxies as a function of dark matter halo virial mass. This is roughly 1/baryon fraction, so we're getting very efficient galaxy formation here. But see, in some sense, this is bad because we've got baryons here. And so when we were focusing on dwarf galaxies, the stuff I was talking about here, that's kind of nice. We can talk about dark matter structure. Here in clusters, again, we may be able to use our dissipationless simulations. But in this region, things get a little bit messy. So on galaxy scales, baryons affect halo shapes, as Julio mentioned. So you've got halos that are elongated, and as gas cools and form these galaxies, it make them more spherical. This might help explain what's going on with the Milky Way and the Sag stream. Currently, there's really no strong evidence that this kind of effect actually operates in clusters. So for example, Flores et al. Studied a bunch of X-ray cluster isotopes and found that they're basically consistent with the shapes of cluster-sized halos in simulations. Baryons also affect the density structure of halos, and again, this is an issue that people are worried about. So as Nedden et al. Showed, dark matter halos should adiabatically contract even in cosmological simulations. But there's evidence against this if you take the claim seriously from the Tully-Fisher relation of late-type galaxies. X-ray studies of massive early-type galaxies, Humphrey et al., basically find that you can't really do anything reasonable with the stellar mass-to-light ratios. You try to include adiabatic contraction, and also galaxy clusters. So there's some evidence, in some sense, you can think of it as evidence against it. At least there's no evidence that this actually happens in the real universe. Although there is some evidence that it may happen sometimes, especially close to home. This is a paper led by Mark Seeger, who's also a postdoc at Irvine, who's constructed a new mass model for M31 with a new baryonic mass estimate. And basically the deal is that the rotation curve of M31 falls off. It peaks and falls off, and it's understood quite well, as well as the mass distribution in M31. You can't explain this without significant adiabatic contraction. So this is the Blumenthal et al. Model, which is about the most that anyone ever talks about. And this is basically what you need to get it. If you turn off adiabatic contraction, it's basically impossible to get this fault off. So I think this is evidence that it happens, at least if you believe CDM or believe something like it, this is evidence that it does happen, at least sometimes. And by the way, you get pretty reasonable masses and concentrations. So I'm going to move on here a little bit and basically just say that another idea is that it may be that adiabatic contraction does operate, but just the typical concentrations of galaxies are lower than we might have thought, one reason or another. And this might not be crazy if you think of bias in the type of galaxies that type of halos that specific types of galaxies sit in. We know that low concentration halos tend to form late, and high concentration halos tend to form early. That's the trend that explains the trend with mass. But it also, almost in a one-to-one way, if you take this plot and slice it at fixed mass, the trend with formation time is very tight. So it's almost like a one-to-one map. This relation is even stronger than the relation with mass. So you might think there's a very good reason to believe that there should be some kind of bias if you're looking at one type of galaxy versus another, that you're looking at a biased part of the concentration distribution. So you might think that maybe late-type galaxies live down here and early-type galaxies live up here. And high concentration systems even cluster more strongly than low concentration galaxy halos. And this is work led by Risa Wexler. So this again might point you in that direction. Now let's think about the concentrations of larger mass systems, now moving to group and cluster size halos. And you can do a similar thing. And again, you show that the same trend happens. And if you look at, for example, the number of satellites or number of subhalos these halos have as a function of the formation time of the object, again, things that form early tend to have less substructure or fewer satellites than things that form late. And you have the same trend with concentration in the number of satellites. So this might suggest, for example, that low concentration systems have many satellites, and these are unrelaxed groups and clusters. Systems that are relaxed, or things like fossil groups, might populate the high concentration tail. You might suspect that what's going on is something like this. Here you've got fossil groups and relaxed clusters. You've got unrelaxed and merging clusters, late-type galaxies, early-type galaxies. So if this were the case, and I'm just presenting this as a possibility, we need to sort it out, because if you're normalizing your model against this, you know, median concentration relation, but you're looking at a specific type of galaxy, you are in trouble. So I'll just close with this figure. This is a figure from David Buat et al. And the X-ray group at Irvine. It's a compilation of 39 relaxed systems. It's XMM and Chandra data, the best data they could get. It includes early-type galaxies, groups and poor clusters, and massive clusters. And what's shown here, and this should be out next week on AstroPH, is the concentration-mass relationship in the X-ray. And one thing you could see right away is that there is a trend with mass. As far as I know, it's the first time this has ever been shown, observationally, that there is a trend with mass. Second of all, I don't know if you want to take this seriously or not, but here's sort of the LCDM sigma 8 of 0.9 line. These massive, very early-type systems are about 1 sigma high. These are very relaxed sort of fossil group type systems. They're about a half a sigma high in the concentration plane. So I think that's interesting. Possibly, you know, it's spelling out this type of picture. So here's my conclusion. For density profiles, Tully Fisher and rotation curves, late types need lower concentrations or no adiabatic contraction. The X-rays, massive ellipticals, relaxed groups, clusters clearly have a C of M relationship and also need slightly higher concentrations than typical. Substructure dwarf counts, we just don't know. We need better data. There's a huge degeneracy in that issue when you're looking at velocity dispersion profiles, in my opinion. Satellite orientation should orient with a major axis of halos. Ellipticals, I think the evidence is good. I think we need more data on disks. Shapes, basically, I think there's general consistency, especially if you take into account these baryonic effects. Okay, sorry for going way over.
Okay, Dennis, coming.
Hi, Dennis Ritsky. Just since I were prompted. Let me just say a few words about satellite orientations and spirals. In a study led by Jeremy Balin that should be submitted any day now, we've been sort of reworking through the entire literature of studies. The problem has been that since our initial sort of Homburg effect detection back in the 90s, other studies have come back and said the satellites are oriented in the other way. So we've been trying to understand what the source of the discrepancy is. We've been looking at numerical simulations on how you pick satellites out and how interlopers come into play and so forth. And we found basically that the problem is in how you define an isolated galaxy. And if you define isolated galaxies differently, you get very different results. So we've gone to the simulations and looked how to really, truly identify things that are isolated. We've applied that to the Sloan data, which is what previous studies had used and gotten anti-Homburg effects. And we actually recover the Homburg effect again. So, so it does look like satellites around isolated disk galaxies do lie preferentially along the poles. And we can reproduce all previous results if we take their criteria for isolated galaxies. So I think the situation is clearing up now.
Okay. Okay.
Dennis?
I like the sort of idea that you sketched about how concentration may vary with population and so forth. And it's certainly very tempting to believe that, for example, the low surface brightness galaxies are in late time formation, lower concentrations, matches, you know, both their stellar populations and their spatial distribution. But the problem I think one has to be careful with is for L-star things, where it's quite possible to attribute a lot of the mass to baryons at small radii, in which case you would infer even lower concentrations for that sort of thing. And so I think, again, baryons are raising their ugly head, and we have to sort out what those are really doing before we can, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I'm worried this trend could, this one makes sense, but it could easily go the other way.
I mean, I was kind of happy that at least the concentration was reasonable for M31 when we included baryonic contraction. But again, it's only one system. It's got a gigantic bulge, you know.
Question?
Jan Koppels. Can you show that plot again where you, for the high mass objects, you show the concentration index? Yeah, so you use sigma 8 of 0.9. I mean, how sensitive is this? Because, I mean, the new WMAP
scales almost like sigma 8 concentration does. So if you bump sigma 8 to 1, it would really bring it up sort of.
Right, but that's in the opposite trend of what's WMAP is giving, right?
Right, oh, WMAP's way low. WMAP, these would have to be, if you took the WMAP seriously with the tilt and everything, these are sort of 90%, 95%. Sorry. If you take it seriously and assume this is a representative population, which I'm not sure if it should be, it's ruled out the 99% level. The really high concentration for the WMAP. That's all. Yeah, because they're picked to be. Yeah, they're exactly. They're picked to be the things. So these should lie high. If these things were low, we'd be in big trouble. But you know, I think it's encouraging that at least we've got some things that have too much dark matter compared to average, you know, so.
Okay, thank you, James. We go to the next speaker. Next speaker is Priya Natarajan.